Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
What will the world look like when the pandemic is over? Fareed Zakaria will be here to discuss his new book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Are human beings inevitably drawn to war? Historian Margaret McMillan will join us to talk about one of our 10 best books of 2020, War, How Conflict Shaped Us. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's January 1st, so let me take a moment to wish all of you a very happy new year. Here's to a much better 2021. I'm Pamela Paul. Fareed Zakaria joins us now. His latest book is called 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Fareed, thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure, Pamela.
I have to start with an obvious question, just as someone who has a full-time job, and you already have, I think, three full-time jobs as the host of a show on CNN, a regular newspaper columnist, a writer. How, in the middle of this pandemic, when we're still in the throes of it, did you go from reporting on sort of the world as it is, and at the same time, write an entire book about what comes after?
It's a great question. And I marvel at it myself, honestly, looking backward. But what happened, if you remember, Pamela, is in the first few months of the pandemic, when the lockdowns began and such, everything really shut down. All my travel, you know, every lunch date, every dinner date, everything went silent. And so I had a certain amount of free time. And I was, you know, grappling with what was going on in the world, how this pandemic was affecting me, how it was affecting people I knew around the world. And I started to jot down some thoughts about it, partly for the columns and the show. But then I found myself thinking bigger. And I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to try and write something about this. And I'm going to do it in the following way. I would get up at 6:30 or so every morning. And I wouldn't read the newspapers. I wouldn't take a look, you know, I wouldn't look at Twitter, nothing, just to sort of keep my head space in that forward leaning, you know, 15,000 feet above the land space. And I'd write for about 3 hours, and then I'd research a little bit. And by 11 o'clock, I would get back to normal life, and I would just get back to the show and the column and, you know, my kids who were also there with me. So I did that for 4.5 months every day. And weekends included. And so it ended up being this incredibly cathartic way for me to deal with COVID-19, the pandemic, because it forced me to think through and process what was going on. I now look back and think I wouldn't have been able to do it any other period, because by, you know, a few months into the pandemic, maybe 3 months into it, by June, July, things had started to come back to normal. And now I find my schedule as crowded as it was. But there was that 4-month window. And I think just as luck would have it, I took advantage of it.
So your mornings were for thinking about the future, and then you kind of fell back to the present come late morning, I guess, early afternoon?
Pretty much. Once my kids would get up and start getting breakfast and things like that, by then, you know, the reality of life intruded so directly and viscerally that I couldn't avoid it.
So, I mean, it's interesting because what you were doing really was thinking, you know, at least two beats into the future, right? We were just getting into the pandemic, and then you have to think about how are we going to get out of the pandemic, and then another step from there. And so I'm curious what your process was in terms of trying to get that far ahead of something that was already moving very quickly.
So I first had to study the science of it to understand how likely it was we were going to get out of it. And what I came to conclude was that while the public health response that we had seen in the first phase of the crisis was going very badly, there was going to be a second phase of the crisis that was largely private sector led, that was therapies and vaccines, that was likely to be extremely successful. And so I felt as though the pandemic was already changing the way we were thinking about the world and already changing behavior, but the pandemic plus the lockdown, but that we were going to enter into a post-pandemic phase. I will be honest, I didn't know whether it was 6 months later or a year later, but you could see if you studied, the people who were doing the vaccines were incredibly bullish on their ability to get this done. Even within the first few weeks, they were saying, we'll have something in a year. Now, to give people perspective, a vaccine normally, by which I mean just 10 or 15 years ago, if it can be made at all, takes about 15 years often. So the fact that they were sure they could compress the time frame so radically was a huge advance in science that I don't think we've adequately understood. But it gave me visibility on a post-pandemic world.
So you also look to the past in trying to figure out what these future lessons might be. To what extent are historical analogies applicable? I mean, you could look at it in terms of previous pandemics like the Black Death or the 1918 flu or very traumatic events like 9/11. And you write about those things. To what extent can you draw analogies? Because, I mean, each case feels very different.
Well, there is one great common thread that has run through much of history with regard to plagues, which is that they were the great killers. They were the great reshapers of society, much more even than wars. Because, you know, until you get to really industrialized warfare, wars didn't kill, certainly not in a year or two, vast numbers of people, because there were set piece battles by mercenaries or conscripted soldiers. They didn't have, you know, until you get to the Civil War in America, you don't begin to have the kind of massive casualties that you have at single battles. So when you look back over most of history, it was plagues that killed people. And people were obsessed by them. You know, the Western literature begins with a plague. If you read the opening pages of the Iliad, it is the story of the plague that Apollo rains down on Greek soldiers because he's had a quarrel with Agamemnon, the king of the Greeks. If you read Thucydides, the Peloponnesian War, big, big event in the war that might have turned the fortunes of the war, was the plague in Athens, which kills not only vast numbers of Athenian able-bodied men who would have been soldiers, but their leader, Pericles, who was considered one of the great wartime leaders. The bubonic plague, of course, is unimaginable. It killed half of Europe and unleashed a whole series of consequences. So I think, you know, it's fascinating that when you look back in history, it had a huge impact. The bubonic plague might well have ended serfdom because it killed so many people that labor became very expensive. But what has happened over the last 50 years is we have gotten increasingly confident about the power of science and medicine. And so we've kind of lost sight of the effect that something like a plague, a pandemic has. And I think this was a mistake because even with the vaccines and the therapies, as we are seeing, a plague has a unique effect on the world economy. This is, first of all, the greatest global event we have ever lived through. If you think about it, and maybe it's because I know a lot of people and talk to people around the world, after 9/11, you know, people in India, people in Brazil, it had no impact on their lives day to day. After the global financial crisis, the places that were not in the Western financial system, you know, leveraged and using all those derivative products, had a very small effect on their lives. It was just the recession that followed. This pandemic is simultaneously affecting almost every human being on the planet. And even if it does it only for a year or a year and a half, that is a huge impact. And the cessation of economic activity is a huge impact. So you're right that we have gotten somewhat cocky about science, but we were wrong in that this pandemic will still end up being probably the most transformative event of our lifetimes.
You write about a post-pandemic world, not just a post-pandemic America. I'm assuming that was a deliberate decision and not a surprising one for someone who hosts a television show called GPS, Global Public Square. But the differences between countries has been pretty profound in terms of how they're handling the pandemic as it plays out. Do those differences in approach to the pandemic now Do you think that those will be significant in the post-pandemic period, or will it be that, you know, sort of once there's a vaccine and everyone is vaccinated, that we'll sort of all be on a level field again, or as much as a level field as the countries were to begin with? Obviously, there are differences.
No, I think you're pointing in the right direction. I think it'll be that there will be big differences that endure, because what the pandemic has done is it's sort of shone a light on the state of governance in the world. And what we've seen, it's almost like a social science experiment, right? I mean, the pandemic essentially is global, and yet you've had these very different national performances. At one level, what is clear is that countries that have strong, well-functioning bureaucratic institutions within governments have done well. It is not a story of dictatorships doing well and democracies doing badly. By and large, China did do well and America did do badly, but that doesn't tell us the whole story, because the real stars were Taiwan and South Korea, both of which are democracies. Singapore and Hong Kong also did well. They're quasi-authoritarian systems, I suppose one would call them. Vietnam did well. It was a dictatorship, but Germany has also done well. So the real lesson there is, as I say in the book, it's the quality of government, not the quantity. It's that you need good, well-functioning institutions staffed by technocrats, systems that are not corrupt, not dysfunctional, and crucially, the legacy of all this, or the performance of all this, has created a trust between the public and these governmental institutions, so that when they tell you wear masks, people wear masks. When they tell you engage in social distancing, you do. That, to me, that lesson seems very profound, because it's a completely different lesson than the whole debate that we've engaged in for really the last 100 years, which has been about the quantity of government. You know, how big is the state? That all those issues, which are capitalism versus socialism or communism, seem irrelevant now. What we're trying to figure out is, how do we get whatever government we have, how do we get it to actually function well?
But isn't it also a kind of cultural question across those different countries that you talk about who did it well, whether they are autocratic or democratic? One thing in common is that there is a kind of not just a faith and trust in leadership, but an expertise in what is denounced currently in this country as elitism, and instead, you know, is very populist, and that the countries that were where the emphasis was on populism and freedom, I guess, independence, allowing people to make their own decisions, the results have been less favorable.
You're absolutely right. There's something there. And maybe one way to think about it would be the collectivism of some countries versus the individualism of others. But I do think one can make too much of the kind of cultural element of it, because you're right that, for example, East Asian countries have done much better, and that in the West, for example, it's been much harder to get people to adhere to these social distancing guidelines. But I don't think it reflects some kind of mass psychology or cultural attribute, because if you know a lot about these countries, Taiwan is a totally chaotic democratic system, a culturally very independent and freewheeling. You know, if you go to the Taiwan parliament, people, legislators routinely beat each other up. I'm not kidding. I mean, it's literally that chaotic. South Korea has huge amounts of internal turmoil. And some of the places that are quote unquote Western countries, like New Zealand or Denmark, Australia, even Canada, have done remarkably well. So I think a lot of it is actually, did you have good government? Did you have good institutions? Did those institutions create an atmosphere of trust? You know, in other words, I do think that trust is key, but I'm a little reluctant to go to that kind of cultural space because, it turns out the culture is very big and complex. You can find in it whatever you like. People used to argue that Confucian culture, for example, was one which would never be able to adapt to capitalism. This was Max Weber's famous argument in his book, The Spirit of Capitalism and Protestantism. So I think there's something there, but I do think it lets us off the hook too much. A lot of this was the failure of government. I think had you had a different president, had you had a different set of leaders, you know, I look at Merkel in Germany, who has managed this really very well. And while the death rate is not as low as it was in East Asia, German death rates are still a quarter of what they are in America.
Did the U.S. do anything right?
Yes, the U.S. handled the public health crisis, I think, pretty badly from the start. Trump minimized it. The CDC sent out the wrong test kits. The Department of HHS was never able to put together a national testing service. But it did the economic part very well. Very quickly, the U.S. Congress and the Federal Reserve put this massive safety net under the economy, a $2.2 trillion stimulus package. Just to remind us, that is about, I think I'm right in saying this, is about twice as large as the Obama stimulus after 08, 09, and it happened half as fast. They did it instantly. And that is one of the reasons we actually haven't seen as much pain in the economy as one might have imagined. I mean, the numbers in terms of unemployment and things like that were worse than 08, 09. The only parallel is the Great Depression. But because we got the economic policy right, we managed to stabilize it. Now, the irony here, Pamela, is that we are now entering phase two, where, as I say, I think we're going to get the public health piece of this right because it's largely private sector led. We're going to have these amazing vaccines. We already have good therapies. I do believe we'll be able to get them out. So we'll get the health crisis right. But if you look at the squabbling that has begun in Washington, my worry is that we will invert this and we will get the public health crisis right, but we will screw up the economics.
I'm curious what metric you're using to say that the economic component has been successful, because one of the things that I think people look at country by country is the amount of aid that has been given to families who've suffered on a household level the consequences of the pandemic. And it's so much lower, the amount of support to families, to working people, to unemployed people here than it is in other developed countries.
You know, there are so many different components to this aid. Some of it went to businesses, some of it went to people. If you look at the totality of the $2.2 trillion, it is the largest aid package in the entire world, with the exception of Australia. If you look at the decline in U.S. GDP growth, only China and South Korea have done better than the United States. So if you look at those two metrics, those are the broadest aggregate metrics you can look at. In other words, compared to the size of your GDP, how much aid did you provide? How much money did you get out the door? The U.S. is the second highest amount of money. And if you look at how much did your economy shrink, the U.S.'s economy shrank less than Germany's, less than France, less than Britain. The two countries that actually grew, major countries, I think, were South Korea and China. So I know that there are some components of this that, you know, look more fair to, you know, so the U.S. provided money to some businesses, it provided money to some local governments, it provided some money to individuals, whereas in other countries, all the money went, or most of the money went, to individuals. So it really does depend on how you look at it. But I think the aggregate measure is the best one to look at.
Do you think the outcome will be worse for those countries where the aid was provided at the individual level?
So far, they have done worse. In other words, their GDPs have shrunk more. But I don't think it's because of that. I think it's because the U.S. is less trade dependent than other countries. You know, most people don't realize this, but 80% of the U.S. economy is the domestic economy, whereas in Germany, only 50% is the domestic economy. So a large part of the German economy depends on exports to other countries. And if other countries are doing badly, they're going to do badly.
You have 10 lessons in this book, and we don't have time to cover all of them. So I want to stay on the economic component for a moment. One of your rules is that markets are not enough. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand what is going on in terms of the effects of the pandemic economically. It is widening trends that were already in place. That is, for example, the massive expansion of inequality. And I don't just mean personal inequality. That is something, and I, as you know, I have a whole chapter and lesson about that. I mean the way in which you are having monopolies and oligopolies strengthen. I give you an example. I write about this in the book, but the book is itself an example of this, which is to say, book publishing, as you know, is actually up over this pandemic. More people are reading books. Book sales are up. But if you look at the start of the pandemic, Amazon was, roughly speaking, 30% of book sales in the United States. Today, Amazon is somewhere between 60 and 70% of book sales in the United States. So what has happened is this massive expansion of the dominant player. this is not just happening in book sales. It's happening in, you know, if you look at Home Depot, if you look at Walmart, if you look at Target, all these companies that are large, have digital presence, have big brand names, have strong credit lines, they're flourishing. The smaller ones, the mom and pops, are being destroyed. Now, this is not a problem you can solve using free market economics or free market theory. To me, it's a metaphor, a symbol of this reality. We are in a phase where markets are producing very efficient outcomes that are bad for us in political, social, moral terms. And that's why I say markets are not enough. We have to use politics to deal with these inefficiencies that are political inefficiencies or these ugly outcomes that we want to change. And that means we have to ask ourselves, you know, how do you regulate markets? How do you redistribute the wealth that comes out of them? How do you, most importantly, provide people with opportunities at the lower level of the income scale, people who are not being incorporated? Because that, in some sense, that's where the real market failure is taking place.
Last question. We don't have time, as I said, to go over all 10 of these lessons. And some of them are not cheerful lessons. One you mentioned earlier is that inequality will get worse. But this episode is airing right after the new year. And so I would love to end on some kind of optimistic note. Is there a lesson among these 10 that you think points to a better future, an upside, if there is one, to surviving a pandemic?
Absolutely. I would say there are two. One is, this is a wake-up call. I think that everyone can see that we have been living our lives in a somewhat thoughtless way, where we've allowed development and we've allowed the destruction of the natural habitat of animals like bats, which, you know, why do we have this pandemic? The natural habitat of the bat has been destroyed in much of East Asia. Bats are living closer to people. Bats have lots of viruses for a variety of reasons. Those viruses then hop to domesticated animals like chickens and pigs, and then they hop from those animals to human beings. So we need to understand better what we are doing that has these kind of risks. And I think this is a wake-up call. One of the things I write about is factory farming, which is an invitation for another pandemic. Thousands of animals crowded together, and the virus will hop from animal to animal, gaining strength. I think all this is becoming clearer. We needed a crisis maybe to focus our minds on it. We're already beginning to take some measures, I think, that will make a difference. The next big one, of course, being climate change. But again, all this, I think, you know, we're having a more serious conversation about some of this. The even more hopeful element of this is it really forces us to cooperate with other countries. At the start of the pandemic, you saw every country turn inward and talk about how they were going to protect their supply chains and look inside themselves. But the reality is you can't solve a global phenomenon with local means. We had to reach out to the world to get medical supplies. We had to reach out to the world for PPE. The science that has been involved in producing these vaccines and therapies is totally globalized. And in the midst of this pandemic, as countries are searching for ways to grow out of their economic misery, what you are noticing, not in the United States yet, but in other countries, is a search for more trade, for more cooperation. So the largest free trade pact in history was signed November 15th. It's called the Regional Economic Partnership, and it involves 30% of the global GDP. It's sometimes described as a China-led trade pact, but it's actually most of Asia. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Trump pulled out of, was signed by all the other countries. The EU is talking about signing a trade deal with China. And that's just one element of it. My point is, I think we're beginning to realize, look, we're in this stuff together, whether it's climate change, whether it's pandemics, whether it's the dangers of cyber warfare or space races, arms races. We're going to have to find some way to cooperate and collaborate. You know, the world is still looking for a leader, an agenda setter, not a hegemon. It will be a very different kind of leadership. There's some good signs out there that if we act on them, it all depends on human agency and leadership. If we have good leadership, we could take the world to a better place over time. That's about as idealistic as I can get.
All right. I'm going to hang on to the good signs that you mentioned. You've given us a lot to think about. It's remarkable that you pack all of this into what is actually a very concise and readable and thought-provoking book. The title of that book, again, is 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World by Fareed Zakaria. Fareed, thanks so much again.
Pamela, you're very kind to have me on. It's an honor and a pleasure.
This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Margaret McMillan joins us now from Toronto. Her new book is called War: How Conflict Shaped Us. Margaret, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You've written historical books about specific wars. What inspired this book to take on the subject as a whole?
I've always been interested in the subject of war, and I've been trying to figure out why. I think partly because when I was young, I was told girls shouldn't be interested in war. So in that sort of spirit, I got interested in it. But also, I'm a historian of the 19th and 20th centuries, and so war comes in a lot. And so over the years, I've read things about war in general. I've read things about changes to society, changes in technology. I was very lucky to be asked to do a series of lectures for the BBC and to choose any subject I wanted. And so I thought this is the time to think about war more generally and think about it through history and try and see if there are things that are common to wars through history and are different. And so it gave me a chance to explore things like technology, who fights, why wars start. It was a wonderful opportunity, actually.
And did doing this series, did the process of exploring the subject through that broad lens change your ideas around war?
They changed my ideas quite a bit, actually, because what I hadn't really got involved in or really understood was the debate about whether war is something that's biologically driven. Are we condemned to war because of something that evolution has left us with? Or is war the product of culture? And so I found that whole debate fascinating, and I began to read quite a lot by sociologists, anthropologists, and so on. And I think I came down on the culture side, that we are programmed to war by our cultures, not so much by our biological natures. So there's lots about war which I hadn't really thought about. The role of women in war, for example.
You don't come down in the camp of evolutionary psychology and sort of evolutionary biology, that this is something in our biological nature.
I don't think it is in our biological nature. I mean, I think what we know that we have inherited as a result of millennia of evolution is a fear of others, a fear of those who aren't like us and don't seem to be a part of our clan or our family. I think we've also inherited an impulse to flee if we're frightened, or to lash out if we can't flee. And so I think those impulses are there. We have other impulses and other appetites. But when you think about war, and I've been reflecting a lot on this lately, war is so organized. It's not a set of impulses. It's actually something that is highly programmed. You have to be trained to become someone who fights. It takes a great deal of training. And so I don't think it's a natural activity for human beings. I think it's something that comes very much with the development of society and with our own cultures.
So where and how does it start?
As far as we can tell, war starts very early on, almost as soon as we begin to get ourselves organized into groups. Now, the further back you go, of course, the less evidence there is. But what seems to be the case, and I say seems because this is always going to be open for debate, is that once we began to organize ourselves into groups, we began to want things that other groups had, or we began to be afraid of other groups. And so we began to have to defend ourselves, or we began to attack others. And when we settled down and became agriculturalists, then we had less opportunity to flee. We had more to defend. And so the very early agricultural settlements that archaeologists have discovered have walls around them. And why do they have walls? That suggests that they're trying to keep someone out and trying to protect themselves. And so the evidence seems to be that with social organization comes the capacity to fight each other, and often the willingness or the longing to fight each other. And the more organized we get, the better we get at fighting, unfortunately.
So also social organization within a group itself, right, has something to do with the development of war, because when you have any kind of society, there's someone on top and there's someone below, and there's someone giving orders and there's someone carrying out orders.
Hierarchy seems to come with human organizations, and certainly with agriculture, because then you get the means to support more people. And then you can have people at the top who don't have to work, who can organize others. And you begin, as you say, to get differentiation. So you will get scholars, you will get the fighters, you will get the tax collectors, and then you'll get the people who at the bottom who do all the work and produce the raw materials that the rest of society needs. And so, yes, I think with organization of society, we get class structure, we get differentiation. And power, of course, is important. You know, if you're at the top and you know how to fight and you're the ones with the weapons, then you're going to be able to push everyone else around. And that is what has happened time and again in societies.
You mentioned at the beginning that you specialize in the 19th and 20th centuries. And so, of course, inevitably, war is a major part of those 200 years. But there's always a war going on somewhere, right? I mean, is it misleading to think about peacetime and wartime as these two very different states of being? And is peace the natural resting state of affairs?
I would say peace is not the natural resting state, nor is war. I mean, I think the two are, again, intertwined like war and society. And you sometimes don't get peace without a war being fought. And in peacetime, you always have the potential for war. I mean, we in the West have lived through what a lot of people call the long peace since 1945. But it hasn't stopped us building military establishments. It hasn't stopped us fighting in different parts of the world. And it hasn't stopped us planning and preparing for war. And so I think war and peace are very, very closely, again, intertwined.
I mean, it also depends on the us in there, too, because when we say that there hasn't been war since 1945, of course, there have been many, many, many wars globally. But I guess if we're talking about the West, we're talking most obviously about the Cold War, which raises the question, what is war? I mean, what do you consider war? Does it have to involve direct military conflict?
My own definition of war, and many will disagree with me, is that war is organized violence. In other words, you have an organized group which will apply violence to gain its ends or to defend itself against another organized group which will also use violence. And so I don't see war as something where just two people get into a fight, and that's not war. War is the organization. It's a group activity. Now, the Cold War was interesting because, in fact, it involved a lot of fighting, but not between the two great superpowers, for which I think we can all be very thankful. But both of them fought. The Soviet Union fought in Afghanistan, the United States fought in Korea, fought in Vietnam. And so there was a lot of fighting. And I think that's the other thing you mentioned earlier on that I think we always need to remember. I mean, you know, I grew up in Canada. I've lived in Canada most of my life. I haven't seen war directly, but I shouldn't think that war is something that's gone away, because there's been a war virtually every year since 1945 somewhere in the world. And of course, we know today there are wars going on.
It's funny that you bring that up, that you haven't seen war directly, and yet this has been your area of expertise as a historian. Obviously, direct experience with something isn't necessary in order to write about it or to have points of view about it. But I'm curious if you ever think about, like, what does it mean that you've never actually seen war firsthand?
I do worry about that, because I won't have experienced firsthand, but then there's a lot of the past I won't have experienced firsthand. I mean, historians kind of lived in Rome or Greece. You know, there's no way we can have done that. And I think what we're always trying to do as historians is, as much as we can, go by the sources, read what's there, see what's there, talk to people who were there, and try and use our imaginations and the materials we gather to try and understand it. And I would never claim that I understand the experience of what it's like to be in war. And I think that would be really presumptuous. But I've read enough people describing it that I can get a sense of it, that what it must have been like. They pick out certain things again and again. And so, you know, I can't experience it directly, but I can, I think, get a sense of it that I might be able to use.
As a historian, what gives you that sense best? Is it seeing things? Is it reading soldiers' accounts? What is it that gives you that texture?
I think it's a combination. I mean, I tend to think historians are like magpies, and we pick up shiny things everywhere, and we don't really know what we're picking up until eventually we begin to build a pattern. And so I read as widely as I can. I mean, I read novels because I think novels often, fiction often conveys a sense that straightforward history can't. I mean, I felt I learned a lot about the Vietnam War, for example, when I read Tim O'Brien's extraordinary novel, The Things They Carried, which gave me a sense of what it was like. But I also read documents. I listen to interviews when I can. I will read as much as I can. I will look at pictures. I'll look at movies. I mean, I think we need to be as eclectic as possible in gathering our material.
You described war as a group activity, which, you know, it's a kind of striking way to describe it. War obviously has rules and it has organization, but has it always, or did those rules and those ways of organizing war develop over time?
I think as far back as we can tell, the organization was there, organizing people into groups, making them stand. The ancient Greeks, citizens of Greek cities, would stand with their shields on their left arms to protect each other. And that was a way of fighting, and it took a tremendous amount of discipline and cohesion. And very early on, we seem to have developed rules as well. Again, to go back to the Greeks, they didn't fight on certain days and they didn't fight during the Olympics. And so the making of rules and the attempts to control war seem to go back just as far as war itself.
In what ways has war been a positive force?
Well, it sounds very odd to even say that it's a positive force, but in some cases, war has produced beneficial results, unintended consequences, perhaps.
Right, not on purpose.
Not on purpose. And you know, sometimes I've been accused, someone got very cross with me and said, you're saying that war is a good thing because it produces these results. And I'm saying, no, I wish we could produce such results in different ways. But war does sometimes produce social change, for example, and changes in the position of women. You know, women in the two world wars in the countries that were fighting showed that they could do the jobs that men had been doing and showed that they could participate in societies. And that made it more difficult to deny them the opportunities to go into the professions or whatever jobs they wanted. It made it more difficult to deny them the vote. War also in the 20th century seems to have brought about greater social equality in most of the countries that fought, because the poor at the bottom end of society had jobs, they were being paid better, they were often eating better, they were treated better by their governments because they were important to the war effort, and the very rich at the top had to pay taxes in a way they couldn't get away from it. And so war has produced beneficial results. But as I say, we wouldn't choose to do it that way.
In the case of women's rights and power, World War II, obviously, Rosie the Riveter gave women experience in certain kind of workplaces that they did not previously have access to. But that was then followed by this incredible backlash, you know, where in the 1950s, women were forced to conform to a much more repressive state of affairs for women.
It's two steps forward and one steps back, I think. Yes, at the end of both the great world wars, the men came home and it was argued that the men should have the jobs and the women should go back into the household, but they never went back entirely. And I think that's the important thing. And getting the vote made a huge difference because women could begin to make their pressure felt in politics and themselves began to enter politics. So yes, I mean, wars don't always move society in a firm upward path and often, of course, move it in a downward path. But often the gains that are made in wars are never entirely reversed.
All right. Well, let's talk about something that's the kind of opposite in a certain way is from progress and movement, which is bureaucracy. What is the relationship between war and bureaucracy?
It seems to be a very close relationship, because if you want to make war, you've got to have a way to make sure that you squeeze the resources you need out of societies. And so you've got to find the men who can fight. You've got to provide them with weapons. You've got to provide them with uniforms. You've got to feed them. You've got to house them eventually. You've got to eventually provide medical services for them. You've got to move them around. And to do that takes a number of things. It takes counting. The introduction of censuses in the 19th century in Europe, for example, was partly driven by the need to figure out, for governments to figure out how many potential soldiers they had. Counting people as citizens. Citizenship rules was partly driven by the need to figure out whether you could actually legitimately ask someone to fight for you or not. Civil services, having people who counted, who made sure that the equipment was good, that, you know, rotten contractors weren't fleecing the armed forces, making sure that you had the ways of raising taxes. I mean, the Bank of England, in England, for example, was created very largely to help pay for England's wars by borrowing money from the English public. And so the development of centralized bureaucracies, the developments of government information about the societies which they're managing is very much, or has been very much, driven by war.
At the same time, and perhaps this is owing mostly to the progress of technology, but war has gotten progressively more brutal. Is that inevitable? Has that been inevitable?
We've unfortunately got a lot better at killing. And so some of the things we pride ourselves upon, the Industrial Revolution, the scientific and technological revolutions, you know, our extraordinary productivity, the ways we keep on making technological advances, have been and can be turned to war. And what you saw in the First and Second World Wars was mass industrial scale war with weapons that were extremely efficient and extremely powerful and got more and more powerful as time went on. And so, yes, it is a great, again, a great paradox, a great irony that war has become so much more dreadful. It's also, I think, becoming more detached. A lot of the fighting in the First World War was, we've seen in the trenches, but actually very few people were killed with things like bayonets. Most of the deaths occurred as a result of artillery. And so war, as it's become more dreadful, has also become more long range. Often those who are ordering the killing or doing the killing don't see the results of what they've done. I mean, you know, today we can have people sitting somewhere in the desert in the United States launching drones that will kill targets in Afghanistan or Iraq. That's long distance war. And I don't know if that's a good thing, that we don't actually see up close. Those who are ordering deaths don't see up close what it means.
Well, here's a further step of remove, which is that when we use the word attack and we use the word war nowadays, it's very often prefaced with the word cyber attacks, cyber war, cyber warfare. I mean, is there a possibility that we just kind of have these completely non-human wars, or, you know, these wars that aren't fought over networks and not on battlefields at all?
It is possible, I think. I mean, throughout history, war has moved into different dimensions. I mean, it was on land, then it was on sea, then it moved into the air, then it moved below the sea. It's now moving into space. And the whole cyber world is a whole new frontier for war, I think. And clearly, cyber war is something that governments and the military are taking very seriously indeed, because the capacity to disrupt someone's network really could cripple a society. If you think of all the things that we depend on through the cyber world to make our societies operate, I mean, the plants that keep our water pure, the things that keep the planes from crashing, all those things can be disrupted. And the result could be, as in old-fashioned war, violence and death. And so, yes, I think we're moving in a direction where war is yet again moving into a new dimension. But what we also see, and this is, again, another paradox, I'm sorry to keep overusing this word, but war strikes me as just being a series of paradoxes. What we're also seeing is fighting on the ground, and fighting on the ground with weapons that are actually quite old, and fighting in ways that go back, honestly, quite often centuries. I mean, there's just been war in the northern part of Mozambique where they've been using machetes. That's something the Greeks or the Romans could have used.
I want to go back to that word paradox, actually, because I'm curious if there is a paradox or a mystery, something that you as a historian studying war are still trying to figure out, something that drives your work.
What drives my work, I think, is this fascination with war and why do we have it? You know, why do we admire it and why do we hate it? I mean, we do both, don't we? I mean, if you go into a bookstore, you will see rows of books on wars. And a lot of really popular video games are about war. A lot of very popular movies are made about war, television series made about war. What is it about war that we find so fascinating? And why do we find it fascinating? And is it really glorious? I mean, I don't think it is, but there are many down through the centuries who would see war as glorious. I mean, in the Iliad, which is very realistic about war and what war can do to people, nevertheless sees it as glorious. And so I just keep puzzling about that. And it's tied to that, is that war brings out the best in us and the worst. You know, you get a sort of self-sacrifice, you get a comradeship, you get a decency in war among soldiers, those who are fighting, and you also get the most hideous brutality and the most appalling war crimes. And so it just is this extraordinary phenomenon which I keep brooding about.
If war is inevitable and sort of inherently human, what would you say to a pacifist, you know, trying to sort of understand this, the nature of war?
Well, what I'd say to a pacifist is you've got to understand the nature of war, because you're not going to have much hope of stopping it unless you do. And actually, I think some of the great pacifists in history did actually study war and try to understand it. I mean, there's a wonderful French socialist called Jean Jaurès, who is one of my great heroes before the First World War, who saw that a war was coming and was worried about it, and actually took lessons and got a young colonel in the army to teach him about war. And I do think you need to understand it, because if you just say all war is awful, then you're not really getting very far. I mean, you may feel better for saying it. And I admire pacifists enormously. I mean, they're often extremely brave in what they do. I myself can't take the extreme pacifist position, which was Gandhi's or Tolstoy's, and that is that you shouldn't ever fight, that the use of violence is never permitted. I think, unfortunately, sometimes you need to use violence to stop something even worse.
Well, speaking of Jaurès, let's end on one of my favorite songs by Jacques Brel, which is about Jaurès. And Margaret, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Margaret Macmillan's new book is called War: How Conflict Shaped Us.
Demandez-vous, belle jeunesse, le temps de l'ombre d'un souvenir, le temps du souffle d'un soupir. Pourquoi ont-ils tué Jaurès? Pourquoi ont-ils tué Jaurès?
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues John Williams and Greg Coles. Hey, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
John, tell us what you're reading.
A book called Other People's Houses by Laure Siegel. This book very much tells the story of her early life. It's a novel, but it's essentially a memoir. In fact, the New York Times Book Review quote on the cover says, a brilliant novel in the form of a memoir. So I'm not sure why it's fictionalized, but essentially in 1938, Siegel was 10 years old and she lived in Austria when Hitler annexed it. And her family moved briefly somewhere else, but eventually, while 10, she was put on a kinder transport to England. And this book tells in sort of discrete chapters. First, it starts with her young life when Hitler annexes Austria. The next chapter is about being on the kinder transport. Then she sort of arrives at Mrs. Levine's house in England, which is the family she lived with first in England while her parents stayed behind. Then eventually her parents actually come to England. They work in the south of the country as a what they called married couples at the time, where her mother was the sort of housekeeper and her father, he was called the butler, but he actually didn't do much in the house. I think these might have originally appeared actually as individual stories in The New Yorker, which is why they kind of each have the feel of a very distinct period of time in this situation. Siegel is still alive. She's 92. She's lived in New York, I think, since the early 50s. And I had only read a novella of hers previously, which I really liked, but that was several years ago. This is really great. It's not what you would think necessarily. It is harrowing, but it's harrowing in a very understated way. She's funny in moments, but it's less a humor than a kind of, it's almost like going back to being the child. And there's something somehow normal about it in a strange way. She doesn't play up the kind of trauma of it, even though that was obviously part of it. It's more a kind of charming, episodic look. I mean, even on the kinder transport, which obviously from an adult perspective would be terrifying and people are coming on to check their numbers and their IDs, she's sort of talking about like the way that the children, after the people leave the train, the children all go out into the aisles together and start singing and dancing. And there's something pseudo-magical about it. It's very beautifully written, even though it's, like I said, it's not highly stylized. I've really loved it, actually. It's not an easy book to describe in some ways.
She's actually written one of my favorite books for children, which is a picture book that I don't own. It belongs to a house in Vermont that my family has been renting for a week of skiing for the past 10 years. And every time we go there, we read that book at least once. And it's called Mrs. Lovewright and Perlis, Her Cat. And it's brilliant in a number of levels. It's one of the rare picture books, children's books, that does not feature any children, which is something that children's publishers are generally loath to do, but I think when it works well, it's really brilliant. Another of my favorite in that particular subgenre is William Steig's Caleb and Kate, which is about a middle-aged married couple that gets into a huge fight. And this book I love because it's sort of about like an old, here I'm going to use a term that will upset people, but like an old sort of, you know, spinstery woman who is very withholding and demanding. And her only relationship seems to be with the guy who delivers her groceries. And she adopts a cat and she puts the cat insistently on her lap because she has a fantasy that this cat will warm her legs and her feet as she sits by the fire. And the cat refuses to conform to her notions of love and won't even purr. And essentially, you know, in the way that like dogs come to resemble their owners, like she sort of ends up with the cat that she deserves, you know? So like it just has all this like perfection in it, like the idea of love right, you know, like she insists that like this is the way you love someone right. And the cat, you know, in his very stubborn way shows her that, you know, she's not in control of that.
I didn't realize that she had written children's books, but that actually makes sense. The charm of that seems familiar. And I almost went into sort of a cat versus dog debate, but I'll leave that for another time. But what I will say is that
that's going to be a very long conversation, John.
Yeah, well, it'll be a bonus episode.
How did you come to this book, John?
Her name has popped up many times over the years, but recently a lot of people on Twitter, for some reason, I think in Britain in particular, there were a couple of people I follow who had read another novel of hers called Her First American, which I really want to read too, and they were raving about it. And I had bought this maybe 3 or 4 years ago on a trip, and so I had it on my shelf and I didn't have the other book, so I picked this one up. You know, I obviously don't say this in a derogatory way, but it is an easy read, especially once she's in England. There's something that description of Mrs. Loveright that you said, Pamela, it reminds me that she's just great on sort of capturing people on the page. And there are all these sort of mini profiles throughout the book of these different people she lived with, whether it was, you know, a married couple or one couple's son who was kind of a little dangerous seeming and she came to sort of loathe him. They kind of hated each other. And she says that at the end of the chapter. And just these perfect descriptions of people. Greg, what have you been reading lately?
I'm also enjoying an easy read right now. I'm about halfway through a novel called Kings County by David Goodwillie. It came out this summer. It's his second novel, but his first novel came out like 10 years ago. He's not a very fast writer. And that first novel followed a memoir that he wrote called Seemed Like a Good Idea at the Time, about coming to New York and trying to make it as a writer and taking various odd jobs. He was a private investigator. He was drafted to play professional baseball, actually, early in his career. And this book revisits that same time. It's maybe set a little bit later than the memoir. Instead of the 90s, like the memoir, this is the early 2000s in Brooklyn, a novel of the creative class, just as Brooklyn is taking off as the center of where all of that creative foment was. So you have, it opens with a music publicist for indie bands and her boyfriend who works in publishing. And it backs up to take you through their climb through the ranks and their struggles to reconcile their creative impulses with the corporate imperatives of music and publishing. You get a look at the art world and the auction scene, but it is also very much a crime novel, a suspense thriller. You find out that Audrey, the music publicist in the book, on her way up was struggling. She was a waitress. She didn't come from money, unlike a lot of people that she's surrounded by. And to try to make ends meet, she gets involved in a crime. And the book opens with somebody who was part of that having gone missing and presumed to have jumped off the Williamsburg Bridge. And she suspects that it was not, in fact, a suicide. And so this is what kind of pulls you through the plot in a really compelling, galloping way, as crime novels do. But the pleasure on the page is very much the more sweeping social novel aspect of it. This is a book that puts me in mind of Claire Massoud's The Emperor's Children, or The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. by Adele Waldman, who reviewed this book for us, or Teddy Wayne's most recent novel, Apartment, was also about the New York creative class in the late 90s and early 2000s. This is a book that fits very comfortably right alongside those.
Well, as someone who moved to Brooklyn in 2000, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, I think you'll find a lot to like.
Pamela, what about you?
So I just read The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett, which is a book that's been discussed on the podcast before. And the premise of this book is like book candy for me because it taps into two things I really enjoy. One is anything about twins, particularly like twins that have been separated. And the other is novels of passing. The book I liked most in that subgenre was a book called Identical Strangers by Elise Shine and Paula Bernstein, which was told in alternating chapters. And it's a memoir about these two women that were separated as part of this famous, now infamous, secret experiment on twins, a kind of big nature-nurture experiment that was the subject of a documentary.
They were separated for the purposes of that experiment?
No, they were. So they were.
The documentary is really good.
Yes. And the documentary, Paula Bernstein is in that documentary, but the documentary I think that you're referring to, John, is about these three brothers. But there was an adoption agency, a Jewish adoption agency in New York that basically was complicit in this experiment to understand the differences between nature and nurture and let families adopt children without the kids knowing that they were actually part of a set of twins. And the adoption agency sort of kept track of them, and the parents didn't know that that's why they were doing it. In this particular case, Paula Bernstein was actually a writer I knew a little bit, and we lost touch, and then she came out with this book. She found out as an adult that she had this twin sister, and it's like one of those creepy, crazy scenarios that I think everyone, you know, at some point imagines, like, what if I had this secret twin and you or suddenly saw, you know, my double in the street? And that's what happened with Paula and Elise. And I think as listeners of this podcast probably know, this book is about the Venia sisters, who are these separated twins, really one of them.
The Britt Bennett book.
The Britt Bennett, yes. One of them leaves the other, and these two twins, Desiree and Stella. And the other thing that this book is about passing. And that's something I think I first became interested in junior high school. I'm aging myself. It was not middle school. My parents had a copy of Light in August by William Faulkner on their shelves. And it was like this really old edition of Light in August. And I remember
you read Light in August in middle school?
I did not go to middle school.
Sorry, in junior high school?
No, I didn't read it in junior high school. I started looking at it in junior high school. Okay. I read it in high school. I was sort of astonished and befuddled by the jacket copy, which said, you know, Joe Christmas is a man who doesn't know if he is black or white. And it's a little bit like when you pick up a book, you know, on your parents' shelf that has like some intense sex scene that you're not quite ready for. And you're like, I don't understand, you know, so I didn't read it right away. But I was sort of transfixed by this idea of like, how could someone not know if they're black or white? Like, how could you not know what you are? And that novel, of course, is about passing in its way, although about many other things. And I read it in high school, but I don't know that I fully understood it in high school. Britt Bennett's book is much more straightforward on that compared with Faulkner, but it does pick up on that very interesting idea of what is passing, why do people pass? And as has been discussed on the podcast, it has sort of two parallel stories, both in pairs that are told in the book, one of the sisters, Stella and Desiree, but then also the story of their respective daughters, and that the idea of passing is explored in multiple ways, in that one of the characters, one of the daughters, is an actress. One of the other daughters is dating someone who is trans. So there's this idea of passing in another gender and gender identity. So she explores it on multiple levels. I think for me, the most interesting part of this book is in that first pairing, the twins, Stella and Desiree. And I wanted to know more. You know, I left, which, you know, it's a funny thing to end a book wanting to know more. And I don't know that, I'm curious what you both think. Like, I don't know that feeling sated and satisfied at the end of the novel is necessarily better than wanting to know more at the end of the novel and still having questions. I don't know.
That's a tough one. It depends on the on the kind of book it is, I think.
And on the kind of mystery that you're left wanting more about, how central it is. Yeah. I can think of a couple of books, Don DeLillo's Underworld and Philip Roth's American Pastoral, both raise a mystery in them that they never answer by the end of the book, but it doesn't really detract.
Here more it wasn't so much a mystery that was left unresolved. It was more that I wanted to know more about these two characters, Desiree and Stella. I wanted to know more. I mean, she moves around in time, which, you know, definitely has its benefits. But I almost like I was so interested in these characters that I wanted every blank filled in. You know, I wanted to know, but what moment did she decide to leave? And
that's also sort of tough. Like, I don't think that's what you're saying about this book necessarily, but it is sometimes frustrating when a book alternates and you feel much more invested in one story than another. And you kind of feel like you're going from, you know, it's like lowering the volume while you're reading the chapters on one person. And then you go back into the other and you're like, oh, this is the book I love. Like, this is what I want the whole book to be about.
Yes, yes.
I think that the Britt Bennett book is, like you're saying, tackles all those big issues, and it's also very the storytelling is very conventionally satisfying. Like it's not a ponderous book about those issues.
No, she's an excellent writer.
Yeah, it gets at those issues through like plot and character in a cool way.
All right, let's run down the titles of what we read again, starting with you, John.
I read Other People's Houses by Lore Siegel.
I read King's County by David Goodwillie.
And I read The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.